From Richard Nixon to Donald Trump, leaders on both sides of the political aisle have described the state of American health care in terms intended to scare and mobilize voters. Our guest this week argues that those cries of crisis have warped the health care debate. He's Bob Hackey, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and colleague, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Every week, we sit down with talented storytellers and analysts to understand how the stories we tell ourselves are shaping our public policy. This week, we're looking at the healthcare debate and the stories swirling around it. To help us, we're joined by a tremendously talented scholar. Bob Hackey is professor of health policy and management at Providence College and the author of Cries of Crisis, a book that tracks the impact of the stories we've told for the last 40 years on the healthcare debate. Bob, it's great to have you here.
It's a thrill, Jim. Thank you.
So we want to talk about the book. We want to talk about the healthcare debate. But I want to take a step back for a second and hear from you how you got to the point where you're studying story and the stories about healthcare in particular as a means of understanding the policy debate.
Well, for me, I think language really matters. Language shapes the way we see the world. So the stories we tell are going to essentially help us understand what policy prescriptions we should use to try to fix the problems that we identify. So as we look over time, Americans have tended to talk about the healthcare system using the language of crisis. And this is not new. President Trump used this same approach in his joint address to Congress last month, talking about a collapsing system. That was something that would be very familiar to folks who were listening to Richard Nixon in 1971.
So let's get right into it then. You're the author of Cries of Crisis, and it's a remarkable book that details the use of crisis rhetoric over 40 plus years of American politics. Tell us about the evolution, though, the moment when the narrative changes to crisis.
Well, that's one of the most interesting things for me in terms of looking back at how we talk about healthcare. For much of the 20th century, the language that we used was really about progress. It was a story of progress. And when we looked at Medicare and Medicaid, for example, it was bringing more folks into the system. And it was the next logical step. By the late 60s, things start to change. And in part, that's due to rising costs and a concern about inflation. But we have also expanded the footprint, if you will, for healthcare within the federal budget. And so Americans start to think about healthcare as a crisis. The interesting thing about this, as we talk about crisis, is that folks seem to have different ideas about exactly what that means. So we're using the same word to, in many cases, describe very, very different things. For physicians, the crisis is about, in many cases, rising malpractice costs. For many reform advocates, it's about the uninsured. For business leaders, it's about costs. Everyone talks about a crisis, but there's no real agreement on precisely what the crisis is. And that's one of our challenges.
Let's go back historically to Nixon. What was his narrative in terms of healthcare? And obviously we're talking in the 1970s here.
So one of my favorite moments for Nixon was his 1971 State of the Union address, because he actually encapsulated both of these themes in one speech, like seriously within a few moments of one another. So on the one hand, he warned the public that if we didn't act, that we would face essentially a breakdown of the healthcare system, that the system was at a precipice, and we needed to act quickly, we needed to bring costs under control, and he had a plan that he was trying to sell to do that. And the emphasis on cost containment was very clear. But he was also trying to increase access. But the next breath, Nixon talked about declaring war on cancer.
Right.
And essentially promised the nation that by 1976, if we followed his path, we would establish National Cancer Institute, we would have a new war on cancer, if you will, that would find a cure to disease by the nation's bicentennial. And he promised essentially if we could put a man on the moon, then we will spend whatever it takes to deal with this problem.
So how, as you walk through the administrations, are there trends? Do Democrats favor one crisis narrative over a different crisis narrative amongst Republicans?
Democrats have tended to use the language of crisis as well. Their principal focus has been on the uninsured. Republicans have tended to emphasize more the importance of cost containment, and also malpractice reform. We've also talked about crises in terms of physician supply, the nursing supply. There's an appeal here. I mean, the reason why we use crisis rhetoric is because we're trying to gain public attention. Uh-huh. And I can have multiple problems, but when I say something is a crisis, I up the ante, and I essentially demand attention. I'm moving up the queue.
You already hit on the parallel narrative in healthcare and in medicine in the United States, which is one of progress and of hope, a cure for cancer.
Absolutely.
Currently, the battle against Alzheimer's, and we could cite many examples. So these two narratives have sort of coexisted in sort of an uneasy dichotomy. I mean, talk about that. We have two strong narratives.
Absolutely.
We see it today still.
And I think, for me, one of the challenges here is that the crisis narrative has some real credibility issues over time. You know, we've been talking about a crisis in the U.S. healthcare system for 40 years. For me, a 40-year crisis is a bit of an oxymoron.
That's a very long crisis.
Because crisis implies an urgency.
Right.
The whole, you know, we talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, there's a classic, 13 days.
Yeah.
You've got to act. The notion that we have a 40-year cost crisis doesn't have a lot of traction. The reason we keep returning to it is that it demands the urgency. And I think that you're seeing that again now. We're seeing folks, and again, the crisis rhetoric depends on which targets we're looking at. So,
is it a bit of the burning platform idea that if you don't invoke crisis, if you don't communicate a sense of crisis, then you're not going to mobilize the political support to change what is a substantial portion of the American economy and something that's personal to everybody all over the country?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that's what every administration has tried to do. Bill Clinton tried to do it. We saw essentially Barack Obama follow the similar strategy. The system needs repair. It needs repair now. We've got to act. There's urgency.
So at the risk of forcing you to put sort of a qualitative value on this, though, is that bad? Is there something wrong with invoking crisis?
Well, I think there is, to this extent, when Richard Nixon issues a warning in 1971 that if we don't act, then the system is going to fall apart, we will have a breakdown. We end up with a Chicken Little problem, because I said the sky was falling. And then for most Americans who are insured, things went on. For businesses who were able to absorb those costs, things went on. And so every time we use the crisis rhetoric and the predicted doomsday does not occur, you erode the credibility of the narrative. And I think that's a challenge.
So for a lot of people, and this is very pertinent to today with the era of fake news and truth and non-truth, excuse me, to a lot of people, and both in and out of the healthcare industry, it's a complicated system we have here. Not every person has the time to learn and understand. I mean, I know in my own encounters with insurers, you want to pull your hair out. And that's just a very tiny microcosmic example. Does that play to people who feed the narrative of the crisis? The fact that most people, or many people certainly, do not understand, it's just this big, complicated, almost scary, quote unquote, system.
I think it does, Wayne, and I think the reason it does is because of what you've just pinpointed. The system is so complex, and actually fixing the system is so complex. As President Trump recently declared, it's complicated. You know, and he's right. It is complicated.
Yeah, it certainly is.
And we've known that for a long time. The challenge, I think, for us is the crisis rhetoric leads us to think about the problems we face as essentially acute problems, thinking about it in a medical analogy. A heart attack patient, you have immediate intervention. Save the patient's life. I think most of the problems we face with the healthcare system are not like that. They're chronic conditions. Rising costs are an issue over time. We're not alone in that. The uninsured, again, a chronic problem because we have lots of people uninsured for different reasons. Medical malpractice, a similar thing. We have ongoing issues with quality. But these are issues that we're not necessarily going to find a cure for. We are trying to manage them. Uh-huh. And so the rhetoric of crisis is ill-suited for that kind of day-to-day management of a problem. We need to build more attention for solving problems piece by piece, if you will, you know, and in many cases, knowing that we're not going to find a magic bullet.
We're gonna talk about the current debate in a moment, but sort of a point of reference. You know, Wayne sort of touched on this dichotomy between American sense of crisis in healthcare, but we're also kind of healthcare snobs, mm-hmm. right? We want to think of American healthcare as the best in the world because the most advanced procedures are being pioneered here. The American pharmaceutical industry is leading the way. Is that fair? Is American healthcare as great as so many people want to think it is?
It is if you're insured. And I think that's what the dichotomy that we see here. We essentially have two healthcare systems. We have a healthcare system that is providing the best care, as you describe, the latest treatments, the latest advances for folks who have the ability to pay. And if you have a significant healthcare issue, the U.S. is a wonderful place to be if you're well insured. If you're not, you're in a parallel universe.
And yet, if you look at the numbers for the nation as a whole, compared to other industrialized nations on Earth, in certain key markers, we lag.
We do.
Life expectancy, for example, infant mortality.
Absolutely.
We have lower rates than many countries. Nordic countries, I think Absolutely. Germany would be higher, and as well as perhaps Canada. And so what's going on?
Well, I think it's to go right back to Jim's point, if you compare insured Americans with those folks in other countries, we stack up well. We're quite comparable. The disparity is the issue. We have a whole bunch of folks who are not receiving preventative care. They are not receiving the kind of services that they should receive, vaccinations, well baby visits, et cetera, because they're not accessing the system. And to use an example, folks with diabetes, which is a major public health problem in the U.S., that requires ongoing management, you know, and ongoing monitoring and care. And if you're uninsured and you are not monitoring your blood sugar levels well, you're setting yourself up for really bad outcomes down the road, hospitalizations, et cetera.
And of course, there's the prevention aspect too, which is the
Absolutely.
Education about the factors that can predispose you to diabetes, such as obesity, among others too.
So we're gonna take a moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. This program can be heard four times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's The POTUS Channel 124. We're produced each week by a remarkable team here at Rhode Island PBS in beautiful Providence, Rhode Island. My name is Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. You can tweet me at JM Lutis. Alongside me, my co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. He's tweeting at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week, Bob Hackey, is the author of Cries of Crisis, and he tweets at Bob Hackey. So, Bob, I want to spend some time here. We want to get into the current healthcare debate. But before we do that, I want to maybe have some clarity on terms for anybody who's listening, who maybe hears these terms, but is maybe some questions about what we're talking about. Can you just, in a word, describe the difference between the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare?
They're the same thing, Jim.
It's the same thing. So just different names.
Absolutely. I think, interestingly enough, that's an evolution that occurs over time. Republicans initially tried to discredit the Affordable Care Act by calling it Obamacare. The President Obama later embraced it.
Right. It was a slur at first.
Absolutely.
Then,
but there is a public policy polling difference,
mm-hmm. Huge.
whether or not you ask about the Affordable Care Act or you ask about Obamacare, and Obamacare polls worse than the Affordable Care Act.
And has for years, by the way, and interestingly enough, in many states, particularly states that voted for Donald Trump, states like Kentucky, which has been very active in terms of expanding its Medicaid program and really embracing some of these reforms, folks tell you that they like Connect, which is the name of their local expansion, but they don't like Obamacare.
But, you know, it's another example of the power story. The story
That's
around
right.
Obamacare, that
right.
single word, is a negative in many people's right. minds.
And words matter.
And
that's crucial, because the language we choose to use is going to structure these policy debates.
Okay, so a couple other quick more definitional terms. Medicaid, Medicaid expansion, and Medicare.
Okay. Medicaid is a program that was originally designed to provide access to health care for the poor and disabled. It has expanded over time. The most recent expansion, which occurred in 2010 with the Affordable Care Act, brought us to a national floor, so that basically anyone who earned less than 138% of the poverty line would be covered.
Okay.
And that was a dramatic change, because prior to that, states had very different eligibility standpoints. Medicare is the program we have for the elderly and also some disabled folks. Medicare is a social insurance program where folks are paying into that. Medicaid is funded through general tax revenues.
So even as we speak, Congress is debating health care.
Absolutely.
What are the narratives in that current debate?
Well, I think there's two narratives. First of all, I think you heard the Democrats talk about making America sick again. And the notion that, again, almost using the rhetoric of crisis, that if this bill is repealed, it will have dire consequences and real consequences for real people. They're focusing largely on access to care. Republicans are telling a different story. They're telling a story about rising premiums on many health insurance marketplaces, diminishing competition on many of the health insurance marketplaces, and also of budget deficit reductions. Each side has a different story they're telling, and I think this is going to be a very interesting debate to watch.
So with these competing narratives, though, is there a line between a false narrative and truth in this debate?
Oh, I think there is. I think clearly we saw some of that this past week with the debate about the CBO, the Congressional Budget
Right.
Office, scoring of the Republican proposal. And now, contextually, the Republicans have a point when they criticize the CBO in that the CBO has not always had accurate estimates, of particularly with the Affordable Care Act, of how many folks would sign up for coverage.
Right.
They had previous issues with the Bush administration's efforts to expand the Medicare prescription drug program. The thing that troubles me is the attack on the credibility of the scoring process and essentially the effort by the administration to discredit the CBO. Because the CBO is a nonpartisan group. It has both Democrats and Republicans included.
That's not what I read, by the way. That's a little joke. but that's the kind of thing you hear.
That's
the kind of thing you hear. And that's a strategy, a deliberate strategy by the Trump administration.
Well, and I think, to be honest, it's not perfect. And it's one number. And several critics have already said, well, there are other ways to look at this because they're not really looking they're essentially assuming that all the taxes stay in place so that
right.
their budget deficit numbers are actually lower than many Republicans think they ought to be. And I think those are valid points. And that's a good conversation we can have about whether the estimates are accurate. What troubles me is the effort to discredit the group and its credibility as an organization that should weigh into the debate.
So why should CBO be given the benefit of the doubt, I guess is the question.
Well, I think they've got a track record, and I think these are all estimates. You know, and anytime we do public policy forecasting, we're resting those forecasts on assumptions.
Right.
And so I think the reasonable conversation we should have is not that the CBO's numbers are bad, but rather let's compare the CBO's numbers with the numbers produced by other organizations, and let's see what the basis for those estimates are. And I think that's a productive conversation.
Well, but that also suggests, though, a more deliberative process than we've seen play out in this cycle, right? There was a time in Congress where you did not necessarily present a fully formed plan. You would have hearings, and there would be a give and take amongst members, and you'd arrive at something that would then have broad enough support that it was going to pass. There was middle of this past week, there was an effort by Congressman Ryan, Speaker Ryan, to introduce some manager's amendments that
yes.
were going to have some profound changes on both Medicaid and the number of people that were going to be covered, but no score. And no apples-to-apples comparison of what does this really mean. So is there something about the process this time in terms of the speed with which Congress is trying to move this that is shaping, frankly, the validity of these kinds of estimates?
I think the Trump administration correctly understands that time is a limited thing here in terms of the window to open this policy debate, keep this debate open. They're trying to get something done quickly, knowing that we have in 2018 a midterm election coming up.
Right.
And asking folks to vote on some of these issues in the midterm election year is going to be very difficult. Not that there won't be consequences if they vote on them this year, but when we're looking at this, I mean, I think that was one of the issues with the Clinton reforms. Clinton took a lot of time to formulate the plan. And by the time we get to September of 1993, we're on the cusp of a midterm election, and the debate essentially just hit the skids at that juncture.
I think for many people reading about the ongoing debate over the last several days, it's been confusing trying to figure out what is exactly going on, both publicly and behind the scenes. And if you recall the origins of this bill, it was almost secretive and mysterious in certain members.
Couldn't find it.
You couldn't find it. So it began kind of like in the shadows. But as best you, the expert, can figure out what you've been reading and studying, can you break down for us who will be covered under the bill as the House will be voting on it, at least as of now?
Well, the big change is to Medicaid. Under this bill, and one of the things, because we're going to keep the marketplaces, we're going to keep a lot of other things. There are two parallel changes. One is we're going to move away from subsidies based on income, mm-hmm. Which has been one of the ways that a lot of folks have purchased coverage through the marketplaces, and we're going to move to a new system where we base the subsidies not on an actual subsidy, but on a tax credit basis, a refundable tax credit that would be based on age. And so younger patients will receive a smaller subsidy than older patients. The difference is, of course, that most of these folks who are younger will actually benefit from this because they're going to receive more money than they would have otherwise. But for the older folks, particularly folks in their 50s and early 60s who are not yet eligible for Medicare,
right.
And particularly folks with lots of chronic health conditions, you're going to see a lot of additional cost. And that's an interesting political dynamic.
Well, so a couple of different places I want to go with this, but there's been the subtext that, you know, ultimately there are some conservative voices that would like to see the elimination of Medicaid.
Yes.
Is that believable? In terms of what they want to do, and is it doable politically in terms as an objective?
I don't think it's doable politically. And I think you could see that with John Kasich and other Republican governors who are stepping up now and saying, look, we chose to expand Medicaid, and we have a real hard time going back to our voters and saying, look, we've decided to repeal those benefits, and when there's several hundred thousand people in my state that are now covered under health insurance that previously weren't. So that's a very tough play within the Republican Party. You're seeing a real schism there. The Medicaid issue would not eliminate Medicaid. The way it would work is that the Obamacare expansion basically for the first 3 years covered 100% of newly eligible folk. One of the beefs that states have had with this is that a lot of folks have come into the program via what we'd call the woodwork effect. They previously did not know they were eligible. They were previously eligible on the lower income criteria. They've now enrolled. For those folks, the federal government's not paying 100%. The states are paying their usual matching percentage. So a lot of states were antsy about expansion because they weren't sure how this would impact their budgets. You know, and we see this around the country. So what would continue is Medicaid would continue to be in effect, but it would go back to the old cost-sharing model. And so the federal government's role in terms of coming in and paying most of in the new going forward, it would be 90% of the cost. That would be scaled back. And so a lot of those folks would then no longer be eligible for Medicaid. And most, if you look at the CBO's numbers, that's where most of the people would lose insurance. This is not really happening until 2020.
Right.
Yeah, we're phasing this in. But
politically motivated? By a couple of years, the program's in place and people aren't losing coverage? And
absolutely. Just as the Affordable Care Act was in 2010. I mean, most of the difficult, heavy lifting to implement the Affordable Care Act didn't happen until 2013, 2014.
Years. Yeah.
Right.
So we've had 40 years of crisis and debate. We're having it now. Where do we go from here? This debate will continue, clearly. I mean, the 2018 elections are... midterm elections are not that far off, and of course we have another presidential election not too much further after that. Where's the debate go? Write the script.
Yeah, it's not going to end.
No, it's not going to go.
If you pull, if Republicans were just to do a clean repeal, it would not be the end of the health care debate.
No.
It seems like no matter what happens, it's not going to be the end.
Well, and I think this is true around the world. Every healthcare system is dealing with some of these same problems.
Right.
You know, the difference here is I think we are talking about this and looking at this reform is very interesting because to go back to our previous conversation about progress, all the other reforms we've worked on have been about expanding the pool of folks that were covered. This is the first effort, really. We've trimmed budgets before, but we're seeing a goal that's a much bigger challenge to the legitimacy of the state in healthcare. Yeah, and I think this. Yeah, I think Steve Bannon has made this very clear.
That's part of a bigger, broader narrative. Absolutely. In this administration.
Yeah, clearly this is a challenge to the legitimacy of government's role as a guarantor of access to health care. Yeah. You know, this goes right to the core of our conversation about whether health care is a right.
Well, let's talk about whether or not health care is a right. Is it?
Well, in the United States, we have a conflicted opinion. On the one hand, it's a right if you present yourself to an emergency room. The emergency room cannot turn you away. We have a federal law that says that. But when it comes to actually keeping you out of the emergency room, so again, to go back to my, you know, my example of a patient with diabetes, I've got someone who needs emergency care because they had not received appropriate primary care beforehand. It's not a right for that person individually. We think about healthcare as both a commodity and a right.
And the cost is higher if you treat people exclusively in emergency rooms.
Absolutely.
So this is going to seem like almost a silly question, but I think it's an important question. Why can't we solve this? We can decode the human genome. We can send man to the moon, to use that tired old one. Why can't we solve this?
I think it's interesting to think about what healthcare would have looked like in this country if it had actually been a part of the Social Security Act of 1935. Mm-hmm. Because Franklin Roosevelt was terrified of the power of the American Medical Association in the 30s. The AMA did not want to be essentially working for the federal government. And this is a long-standing narrative. We've heard doctors from the first decades of the 20th century right to the present day argue, look, you know, we're concerned about professional autonomy. We're concerned about the doctor-patient relationship. We're concerned about reimbursement. And so there's a lot of, to be frank, Wayne, I think there's a lot of money at stake here. You know, this is an industry that represents about 1/6 of the American economy. And everybody is interested in reform, but no one wants to have a reform that adversely impacts their own organizational professional self-interest.
Or their income.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. And, which is interesting to kind of circle back to Medicaid. This is why so many hospitals are advocating against the Medicaid cuts, because for hospitals, if those folks aren't covered by Medicaid, most of them are going to be uncompensated care.
And
the hospitals
they're
going to take it on the chin.
This is a fascinating conversation, and one that I think is going to be with us for a while. We hope we'll have you back, but we're out of time. Bob Hackey, thank you so much. The book is Cries of Crisis. It's a remarkable read. I highly recommend it. If you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. We hope you'll join us next week for more Story in the Public Square.